Claire Harmon's biography of Robert Louis Stevenson, the creator of classics like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Treasure Island, A Child's Garden of Verses, and Kidnapped, was called Shrewd and Sparkling by the New York Times Book Review. Myself and the Other Fellow is published by HarperCollins and brings Claire Harmon to my show today. Hello.
Hello.
You have called him the least Victorian of Victorian novelists. I assume you meant that as a compliment.
Yes, I certainly did.
Well, there were some pretty good Victorian novelists.
Excellent Victorian novelists, of course. But Stevenson, you know, he died very young. He died just before the turn of the century. Had he survived as long as, say, Hardy, Thomas Hardy, who was a contemporary of his, he would have, I think, been more obviously a modern writer. I mean, he chose shorter forms. He admired the Victorian novelists very much. His, you know, the people like George Eliot and Dickens, he revered these writers. But he knew that his mode was completely different from them. He liked short, snappy forms. And so he was really a precursor of the next age. He just didn't survive into it.
He seemed to be interested in things that were very much going into the next century, like psychology.
Yes, yes, he was. He was fascinated by that. And he was reading some of the literature that Freud was reading. I mean, they were contemporaries. And Stevenson, again, just predated all the quantification of psychology and psychoanalytic literature. So he was able to write in a very free way about things that were in the air, but they weren't quite yet on the page.
Well, like Hardy, he also wrote poetry. But I think it's fair to say Thomas Hardy was the greater writer.
You mean generally across
yes.
the board? Yes, I think probably Hardy. Well, depends what you like. Stevenson was a very versatile man, and he was also a much more optimistic character, and his writing does many things that Hardy couldn't even approach.
But many of his friends felt that he didn't live up to his potential.
That was probably because he exhibited so much potential. He was an incredible live wire. I mean, imagine this tremendously thin, hyperactive Scotsman bouncing into the room. I mean, people couldn't get over how vital and exciting he was as a presence. And his prose was also extremely beautiful. So they had every reason to think that they were in the, you know, in the company of an incredible literary phenomenon about to explode. And he did explode, perhaps in a rather messy way.
How much of his, what he was about, was due to the fact that he was a Scot?
I think a lot of it. I think his Scotsness actually completely informs and deepens his English prose style. I mean, I don't think he could approach the beauty of prose that he does unless he was a Scot and fighting against a dying dialect, you know, wanting to preserve certain dialect words and certain cadences and nuances. Scots English is a fabulous vehicle, and he was a great driver of it.
Well, Scots today, the writers tell me that they consider Robert Louis Stevenson and James Hogg their two greatest writers.
Oh, that's interesting.
And do you think that he inherited his interest in storytelling from both of his parents or from the fact that the Scottish culture loves storytelling so much and has so many wonderful stories to tell?
Yes, well, he was addicted to narrative. I mean, and that's really why he's a very good writer, because he knows what an audience wants. He himself craves a really good ripping yarn. And, of course, the ballads, Scots ballad tradition, and the stories his nurse used to tell him and his parents all fed into that. And he was just completely voracious for a good story. I mean, that's why you get a book like Treasure Island that's a total page-turner and very, very exciting, because the author hated to be bored.
Well, he attended law school because his father wanted him to. Yeah. They were in the lamplighting business?
They were in the engineering business, really. The grandfather had been a lamp maker, and they then became makers of lamps on a very large scale. They were lighthouse builders. So many of the most famous and beautiful lighthouses around the Scots coast were built by the Stevensons. That's what they were famous for, and that's what Robert Louis Stevenson was expected to do, but didn't want to.
So what did his parents think of writing as a career?
Ridiculous. I mean, an absurd thing to do. They made him really become a lawyer because they felt that nobody could be a writer. It was completely against the grain. It was like saying, I'm going to give up and lie in bed for the rest of my life.
What happened when he had successes? Did they change their minds?
They did, to a great extent, yes. And his father took a couple of decades to come round to the idea that his son was a success. But it did take a long time.
Did he ever use his legal education in his writing?
Not much, no. There are a couple of legal characters in The Weir of Hermiston, which was his last unfinished book. There's a famous hanging judge character, although that's based more on Judge Braxfield, who was from the previous century, so it's a more historical than legal precedent. But he loved to depict fusspot lawyers. I mean, he's very satirical about the law, mostly. There's a lawyer in Kidnapped who's not a great sexy character.
Well, you describe him as a sort of early bohemian. He dressed in a unique way.
Yes, the velvet coat and the long hair and the general wispiness. He was a sort of French surrealist poet who'd got washed up in Edinburgh. And he was the most incongruous sight on the streets of that, you know, that rather dour and bohemian town. He stuck out much more than he would have done in Paris.
Did people think he was effeminate?
Very much so, yes. I think he courted that and enjoyed getting a rise out of people and irritating them.
Well, he got involved in some the seedier side of Edinburgh, but it was sleeping with prostitutes. Was that typical at the time?
I wouldn't know if it was typical at the time. I think young men of that class did use prostitutes on the whole. But of course, Edinburgh being a very church-going and God-fearing town, it made the thrill of the double life more exciting.
Some people even thought that his illness was due to syphilis, but he was a sickly child, wasn't he?
Yes, he was a weedy little boy, and he had lots of lung complaints. So when he started spitting blood in his late 20s, it seemed absolutely on the cards that he had TB. But, you know, his upbringing was so anxious and hypochondriac that it's hardly surprising he became an invalid. I mean, that's what he was trained to do.
He had a sense of humor about his condition. He called himself a professional sickist.
Yes.
His parents, but there are some people who actually thought that this was all psychological. Was it? Is it possible to psychosomatically spit up blood?
No, I don't think it is. Although psychological elements exacerbated his illness, I think he clearly was a very frail person. And he had collapses. I mean, there were times when he had to just go to bed and rest for weeks.
And then he died at 44, which suggests that it was anything but hypochondria.
Yes.
My guest is Claire Harmon. Her latest book, a biography of Robert Louis Stevenson called Myself and the Other Fellow. It is published by HarperCollins. That title will be taken by most people as a specific reference to Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yes, well,
your intention?
Yes, it was my intention, because duality, I mean, that theme of the dual nature is right the way through all Stevenson's work. Jekyll and Hyde is the most egregious example of that. I mean, it's now become the myth that people refer to when they want to talk about a split personality. But it was one of many works in Stevenson's oeuvre that dealt with the same preoccupying theme. And that particular phrase that he uses was in a letter when he's talking about his own consciousness. He's not talking about a fictional character. He's talking about his own division between a rational self and an irrational subconscious.
Although some critics think that the book is about repressed homosexuality.
It's got a lot of indicators that we would now interpret as sexual indicators. And it's an all-male story, basically. Again, I mean, whatever Stevenson was referring to as the hidden thing, he doesn't specify. So it's not a limited story about sexuality or about any other kinds of conflict, but it's certainly about conflict.
Well, although pretty much all of his life seems to be heterosexual. In fact, he even got married later. The book sold 40,000 copies in Great Britain and 250,000 copies in North America, which, to my mind, sounds like an incredible bestseller.
Yes,
at least in North America. Was he more popular here than he was there?
Yes, he was. Mind you, the 250,000 copies, and this was within the first 6 months of the book being out, those were all pirated editions, because this predated the copyright laws that would have made it possible for Stevenson to make a fortune out of that book. But he did make a lot of money out of it, and he was very popular in the States. I think partly because of the serial magazine culture here. People like McClure, who were making popular literature very accessible to the, you know, the masses. Stevenson just fed into that moment very well. He could provide fantastic serial stories.
Well, Treasure Island had been an earlier book and also a bestseller. How did it sell in comparison with Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde?
Much slower and not as dramatic a set of sales, because it started off in a children's magazine. It was called Young Folks, and he published it under a pseudonym. He called himself Captain George North, thinking that writing a children's book might slightly detract from the dignity of his other works. So it just, you know, it was only read by a few avid 8-year-olds for the first year or so, and then it got published in book form. And then people like William Gladstone were reading it, and it was taken up as a thrilling story for adults as well. A bit like the Harry Potter books. I mean, they were published in the same mode, just for children, and now they're thought of as for everybody.
He wrote it very quickly and wrote it for his stepson. Mm-hmm. But you get the feeling that if he hadn't written it quickly, he might have abandoned it. What determined whether he would finish something that he started?
Pure luck, actually. And Treasure Island did get finished through circumstances. He started to write it, got stuck. But in the meantime, an editor had seen the early chapters and wanted to publish it. So it was in proof, and it was about to be, you know, it was actually getting some responses from readers of Young Folks, and Stevenson didn't know what the end of the story was going to be, but he had to plow ahead and write the end of the story.
The serial form forces you to do that. You can sit on a book for years, yes. But if you have to give another installment, you better come up with something.
Yes.
He also wrote poetry, nonfiction, political commentary, which sounds like he produced a lot for a man who let so many of his projects go uncompleted.
Yes, well, he was like a firework display on a kind of damp weekend night. You know, some of these things didn't go off, and some of them were absolutely spectacular. But he always wanted to be lighting the blue touch paper. You know, he wanted to be having a beginning. He loved the adrenaline rush, and he was obviously a kind of an adrenaline junkie. Loved making out lists of chapters, loved making out titles for books, but sitting down and writing the book, you know, he admitted, and he was very funny about that. He admitted that it was a tedious chore.
Was it the fact that he traveled constantly also a problem? He would go from one European resort or spa to another in hopes of getting better.
Mm.
It's more difficult to complete a piece when you're doing that, is it?
Yes. Well, one of his aphorisms from an early essay is to travel hopefully is better than to arrive, and that's just such a good summation of his whole attitude. You know, actually the journey is the thing. Getting there is not what he's after. He actually wants to be on the move. He wants to be getting stimuli and actually also getting away from things. I mean, clearly traveling was a way of escaping.
But he was also trying to get better.
Mm.
And that was typical of the times, wasn't it? You'd go to a spa for a rest cure. He eventually wound up in Samoa. How did he end up traveling so much of the end of his life in the South Pacific? Was he bankrolling it with his royalties?
He was suggesting a book about the South Seas. He hadn't been there. He was looking for a warm climate to take his feeble lungs. And his wife hired a yacht, and so they went on one cruise. And in the course of that very expensive cruise, during which he was meant to be writing a book but didn't quite, he realized that the conditions in the South Seas were very congenial to his health. So, you know, again, a bit on a whim, they saw an estate for sale, or didn't even see it. I mean, they just heard about an estate for sale in Samoa and bought it and lived there for the rest of his life.
What about that marriage? His wife was older than he was, Fanny Osborne. She had children. He said at one point, marriage is a step so grave and decisive that it attracts light-headed, variable men by its awfulness. That doesn't sound like it was a very good marriage.
I think it sounds as if it was a very good marriage because of his open-eyed, humorous attitude to this. He was very sort of satirical about the situation that they both found themselves in. I think they were very much in love, but also nothing about his wife was beyond Stevenson's imagination. She was a famously difficult woman to get on with. You know, she was very jealous of other women and very kind of jealous of Stevenson's attention.
Wasn't she mentally ill?
Towards the end of his life, she did start to display psychotic symptoms, and they had a miserable year or two in Samoa when she was clearly having a sort of breakdown, which could well have been because her function had been reduced very much. She'd been so used to being his nurse and his sine qua non, as she was called, that when he began to improve in health and lead a more independent life from her, I think it was more than she could cope with.
Stevenson seemed to worry for much of his life that he would not create his masterpiece, would squander his talent. Yet when he achieved fame from Treasure Island and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, he ran from it, didn't he?
In a way he did, but then who can judge what their great works are within a lifetime? You know, it's very hard. It's posterity and it's other people who make these decisions. And Stevenson didn't want to be known as a sensational writer, although he wasn't snobbish about it. His friends were snobbish about Jekyll and Hyde, but Stevenson said, well, you know, what does it matter? This is the work I do, so put up with it. But he was most proud of things that we don't remember him so much for now, which are the essays and the much more formal and considered pieces.
When he applied for a teaching position, he asked his friends to write false letters of recommendation. He asked one friend to state all you can in favor of me, and with your best art, turning the difficulty of my never having done anything in history, strictly speaking.
That's quite a thing to ask a referee to do, isn't it? Could lie entirely about me, you know.
Say
that I'm good, even though I've done absolutely nothing. I mean, it's a very funny episode, and he was clearly delusional about that, but he really wanted to be somebody back home in Edinburgh on a salary. He wanted the money.
You relied a lot on his letters. Is there a large repository of them somewhere?
Well, there's a huge repository at Yale, but there's also the fantastic 8-volume Yale edition of the collected letters. The letters that haven't been published are not from Stevenson, but to him. So there's an immense archive of Stevenson material. But the editors of the Yale letters just did an impeccable job collecting and footnoting his correspondence. And it's fascinating. It's really excellent. I mean, he's a great letter writer, but he's also very exposed in his letters. So as soon as I'd read the 8-volume Yale letters in the 90s, I just knew that
The eight volumes?
8 volumes, yes.
You knew that you had to write
a biography. I had to write a biography of him, yes.
Clara Harmon's first book, a biography of the writer Sylvia Townsend Warner, won the John Llewellyn Rees Prize in England. Her second, Fanny Burney, a biography, was shortlisted for the Whitbread Award. She has also published editions of Robert Louis Stevenson's essays, poems, and short stories. She teaches at Columbia University School of the Arts. Her latest is Myself and the Other Fellow, A Life of Robert Louis Stevenson. It is published by HarperCollins, and I thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you very much.